Well, thank you, Dirk, for the introduction, and thank you for Tristan and the organizers for inviting me here. The title of the workshop was very intriguing to me because teaching the codex. I thought that's very good because I'm working on the codices, and so I don't want to be left out, basically, and I'm glad that I can be here. So I'm working now for the last, I don't know, 15 years probably. I've been working on a group of manuscripts, a very large group of manuscripts that come from somewhere here in China. You can see this part of China, and I give you the Eurasian context. Africa is for some reason dark, but basically they are in northwestern China. So this northwestern part of China is culturally and historically is actually quite distinct, different from central China, the region Chris was just talking about, where you find these early Chinese manuscripts, or most of them. And the northwestern part is basically Chinese Central Asia, right? So it's, if you look at it, it's in distance, it's just as far from Hong Kong or Guangzhou, these Shanghai, somewhere here, as say from Uzbekistan or Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan and even Afghanistan. So it's actually between two worlds. This is also why they're referring to the Silk Road, right? So these are Silk Road sites. You can see this group of manuscripts. They were found in these Buddhist caves, in one cave. And there are near a city called Dunhuang, which is probably goes back to some Iranian, originally Iranian toponym, but now it's obviously it's very much part of China. So in 1900, in one of these caves, there were about, let's say about 50,000 Chinese manuscripts were discovered, and another 25,000 Tibetan manuscripts and a few thousand other manuscripts in other languages, such as Sogdian, Tocharian, Sanskrit, and so forth. So some of these languages were actually deciphered based on this discovery. So after graduating, getting my PhD, I was hired by the British Library for a project working on these manuscripts, because as it happens, these manuscripts were acquired, or a very large portion of them were acquired by somebody, a person called Oral Stein, who was working for British India at the time. So eventually they found their way to the British Museum and then to the British Library. So even though we are decentering them, right? So even though they were originally produced here in northwestern China, they are in the British Library. Also, a sizable collection is at the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris and some other parts of the world. Almost nothing is left here in Dunhuang. There are more than 10,000 in Beijing, in the Chinese capital, but that's actually one of the smallest collections. So I was hired by this project partly because I was involved when I was doing my PhD. I was involved in digital humanities. I spoke the languages they needed, Chinese, Japanese, Russian. And so they wanted me to be sort of a project manager for this project outside of Britain. And so I traveled a lot and sort of made sure that we were represented in China, in different parts of China, and also in other parts of East Asia and Russia. And so recently, actually, I started working with specifically codices, because you find these codices in this collection. So this is, if we talk about the definition of codex as being a composite of quires, right? You can see that you have four quires here. And this is the exact same book structure that you see in the West, in many places in the West. This is it's wonderful to see it's enlarged like this, but in reality, it's probably the size of my mobile phone. So it's a very small manuscript. And even though there's a scale here, you don't realize this until you go and look at it, and you're like, oh, this is it. Because we never look at this. I mean, people, now I do, but I still, when I see a new manuscript that I haven't seen before, quite often I'm surprised that it's actually the size of a credit card. Very, very small. So I've been working on these manuscripts, and I thought for this particular event, this would be a very good, a fitting subject. And so I'm introducing them a little bit here, very briefly, and I'll talk about pedagogical considerations as well. So this is, again, similar size. This is an opened codex from China. You can see that they're, it's actually sewn together. So the quires are sewn together from the center fold. And the in this case, this is an interesting case because you have this stub, which you also have in Western manuscripts sometimes. But in this case, it's pasted onto the folio next to it. And as you can see, the script is written after this
pasting, and also after the whole thing was compiled and put together.
Here's another example of a cover. This is a student's copy with a text that's a primer. And the interesting thing about these manuscripts, it's not exceptional, but quite a few of them have this, is that they're folded. They've been folded. So you can see the folding line here.
And today in the British Library or the Bibliothèque Nationale, they are flattened, of course. So every time you get a manuscript out, you take it out of the
sort of the
packet or the envelope in which in it, then it kind of jumps back. It tries to become folded again as it used to be. But our conception of these codices is that they should be flat. So we flatten them again by force. The interesting thing about these is that they appear in China or in this part of China around the late 9th century. So the earliest dated one, because there are quite a few dated one, comes from 899. And that's very interesting for a number of reasons, because obviously this is not an invention. This is not a local invention, right? So this has to come from the West somehow, because it's a relatively new development in China. But by this time, this part of China, so Dunhuang and the region of Dunhuang, is completely cut off from the rest of China. Nevertheless, we have textual references to this book format in central China before this. So interestingly, as tempting as it is to assume that this codex form comes to Western China from the West, it probably goes there from central China and much before than this. But for that, we don't have any material evidence.
Here's another very nice copy, which shows basically one chapter of the Lotus Sutra, which talks about, you know, if you get into trouble, like you are on a merchant ship and your ship is blown to the land of the Yaksha demons, I assume this is a Yaksha demon, then what you need to do is you call out the name of Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, or Guanyin, and you'll be delivered from any difficulty. And so it goes on and lists all the kinds of problems, like being in jailed or something like that. All you need to do is call out the name of this bodhisattva and you'll be freed. This is obviously a Buddhist text. Altogether, there are about 400 manuscripts like this out of the, as I said, 50,000 Chinese manuscripts. So this is a very small minority of them, but it's a sizable body of evidence for the use of codex in
Western China. So it's not an accident. They're not because somebody brought a copy or something like that.
Having said that, you have one Hebrew manuscript also in this format. It's not clear what it is because it's sewn together here, and the sewing line is exactly on one line of text. So I'm assuming this was not
a codex form. This is not a bifolio, but this was in another book form previously,
which was then sewed together. But from the way it looks,
it's actually very similar to these bifolia
that I put together. Interestingly, clearly it was also folded several times like this. So this is kind of an enigma, but I'm showing this because this kind of demonstrates the contacts, the extremely wide contacts that you have with this part of China, between this part of China and, say, West Asia.
And it's obviously in a different language.
As is this one. So this is a Tibetan
codex, or a bifolio from a Tibetan codex.
And you have several of these, so you have several dozen, probably,
of Tibetan ones, which is, again, quite interesting.
And here's another example. This is from, not from the same corpus, but this is from further west, about 2,000 kilometers to further to the west, so even closer to the Kazakh border, the Central Asian states. And this is a Chinese, originally this was a Chinese scroll, and then it was folded and bound again as a Uyghur manuscript. You can see that here you have Uyghur text, and the Chinese text is on the inside, usually not seen. Which is, again, very, very interesting. But these date from probably about two centuries later than the ones from Dunhuang. And then finally, interestingly, the same book form, so basically the codex book form, also appears in Japan. So you have this book, an anthology of Japanese poems from the 12th century, and it's bound in the same form. And until very recently, Japanese paleographers, they considered this a Japanese invention because they looked at the Chinese manuscript culture, and they said, well, in China, they don't use this form. So we Japanese invented this. And then recently somebody realized, yes, in mainstream Chinese culture, you don't have it, but in Dunhuang, you actually have hundreds of copies of these books. So that's very, very interesting. Obviously, it did not come from, it was not invented in Japan, but it came there from China. And here's an example from the Cambridge University Library of a Japanese book. This is fairly new, probably late 19th century or early 20th century, but it's also still bound in the same way. Interestingly, this book form has a specific usage. So it's not used for anything. It's used for native Japanese writings, diaries, poems, but it's not used for Chinese texts, which are also very, very popular in Japan, or not used for Buddhist texts. So in terms of the distribution of this this kind of book form in East Asia, we can see that I placed this blue dot here in central China because this signifies sort of an 8th century attestation of this form in textual references. But we don't have real evidence. But we have actual evidence, material evidence from this northwestern part of China and also from Japan.
Now, after this introduction into the codex in China, I want to talk a little bit about
teaching the codex.
So basically, you can see on this picture, you see my students at the British Library with the curator. They're looking at one of these small Chinese codices, one of these booklets, and they're all interested, or they look interested. That's actually one of the problems.
So,
pedagogical tools and considerations is that I think the first thing is that I have to make my students interested in this. So when they apply to Cambridge, right? They know I work on these manuscripts and everybody's super interested. When they come, after they've been accepted, this interest evaporates and they kind of go back to what they used to be doing, which is working on text. And I try to press on them that working with manuscripts is extremely important. You get an enormous amount of context, which you don't have from the text. It's right in front of you, but they're not familiar with this, so they prefer to work on the text. They prefer to work with transcriptions. So I'm trying to get them away from print, get them away from transcribed text, and also I'm trying to get them away from digital images. I say, go to the library, look at the original. And so this is kind of one of my main battles. I think I've successfully converted at least one of them, who is a complete converted person now. She travels throughout Europe looking at these manuscripts, and if you ask her a question, she just wouldn't stop talking about them anymore. So she's going to be a paleographer or a codicologist, obviously. And she came with a completely different topic. But otherwise, it's a challenge. I mean, one of the things that I'm trying to do is that to make them look at the originals, right? You have to look at the originals, or at least you have to look at the images. So looking at images is good, but it's the second step, or second best thing to do. But for us, actually, many of the manuscripts are not digitized, so you cannot look at them. So, yes, there are many exciting digital developments, but one of the basic fundamental things to do would be to digitize all these manuscripts and make them available for us, and they're not. And I worked at this project with the digitization of these manuscripts for 10 years at the British Library, and people were always asking me, when are you going to finish digitizing them? When it's going to happen? Why are you so slow? And of course, well, it wasn't just me, but it's a whole procedure. But now I get to be on the other side and I ask them, why aren't they digitized yet? Can you be a little quicker? Which is actually quite good. Here's another example. So as part of my initiative to make the students look at the manuscripts, I several times a year, I take them to the British Library and we look at the originals. Again, this is a not necessarily clear case thing because we go to London. It's a paid trip. Of course, everybody's interested in the manuscripts, but maybe not necessarily. So it takes a lot of enthusiasm from on my part to kind of get these things across. Another thing is that, as Judith was talking about this, I thought it was a very important thing, is that to teach them what to look at. What do they need to see? So when they get here, they're amazed. They say, whoa, this is a 10th century manuscript. Wow, we've never seen it. We've never touched it. This is fantastic. This is wonderful. They look at it almost like as a relic, as being in a museum, right? They enjoy the sight or the sort of the touch of it, but they have no idea what to look at it. So they immediately start reading the text. They think the text might have a variation with the transmitted version of the text, but not always. Sometimes it doesn't, right? Sometimes it's kind of pretty much the same text with very minute differences. But we need to teach them what to look at. Look at the ruling lines, look at the margins, the book form, all these things which are not intuitive, so they don't know what to look at. The other thing I try to do, and I think it's very, very important, at least from my point of view, is that these are manuscripts from the Silk Road. These are manuscripts from Western China, Central Asian manuscripts. So I want them to be able to look at a wider context and not only focus on Chinese manuscripts, but look at other manuscripts in the region, other manuscripts that were found together with these manuscripts. So manuscripts in the Uyghur, in Uyghur, in Tibetan, in Sanskrit. In China, there's been a century of studying these manuscripts, but they're always looked at as Chinese manuscripts, as part of Chinese culture. And I think it's very important to, at least for us, who are not Chinese, and maybe we don't have that very, very, very immediate connection with this culture, that we have the opportunity to step back and sort of take a wider look and see, for example, the codex. Where does that come from? Because the way it's taught in China is it's a step in the development of the Chinese book. It's a dead end because it doesn't go anywhere, but it's one step. So people were using the scrolls, and then somebody discovered or, I don't know, invented the codex, and they said, well, actually, it's much easier to flip back and forth. It's much, much more convenient than a scroll. But my question is, so for 1,000 years, everybody was using this obsolete, bad method. Nobody thought of this. And then suddenly somebody came along and said, this is how you should do it. Obviously, it's not the case. It's an introduction from the outside, right? And it's, unless you look at other manuscript cultures around, the Chinese one in this region, you will probably, it's not that you don't notice it, you never think about it. Because you only look at, you're mesmerized by the text, by the Chinese characters, and you only look at the procession in China. Okay, so one of the things also that I decided to do, kind of to enhance this participation, student participation, is this, that I organized the conference, a graduate student conference, specifically on Chinese manuscripts. So we had it in May this year. This is one student talking about Manichaean manuscripts. I think they are in Sogdian and other languages. So she's making a conscious step to kind of move away from the Chinese-only paradigm. And she's doing a wonderful job. There's an incentive here, is that the next bit of this conference is going to be in Paris, so we all travel to Paris. So everybody, again, is very interested in manuscripts. Because only the ones who, yeah, only the ones who have something to present are the ones who come. This is in the Cambridge University Library, in one of these back rooms, and so we have we had a small exhibition of books related to, in this case, not Chinese manuscripts, but Tangut manuscripts, which are another language spoken in northern China until the Mongol period, or before the Mongol period. And so we have all these books there, and the students are actively engaging. And we also organized, actually, language classes for this. So we had somebody for a whole year teaching Tangut. And then we have, I also have this shadow figure. We can do this too. this is George Keyworth from Canada. He's talking about these manuscripts. So we have a lecture series that are mostly on manuscripts. And this is every Thursday. And actually, I have to go back today because of this, because I'm hosting this at 5 o'clock tonight. And we're doing this, we've been doing this actually for, or I've been doing this for about 5 years now. And this is a major, it's making an impact, also on students, but also on other people interested in the topic in Cambridge. So that's been working out very well. Fortunately, we have funding for this from a Buddhist organization. So we are quite happy. Here's another professor, Nugent, Christoph Nugent from the U.S., and he's talking specifically about some of these codices from Dunhuang. So basically, this is what I wanted to talk about. Thank you very much.